Books on Tape presents The English Assassin by Daniel Silva, read by John Lee. Prologue, Switzerland, 1975. Marguerite Rolfe was digging in her garden because of the secrets she'd found hidden in her husband's study. It was late to be working in the garden, well past midnight by now. The spring thaw had left the earth soft and moist, and her spade split the soil with little effort, allowing her to progress with minimal noise. For this, she was grateful. Her husband and daughter were asleep in the villa, and she didn't want to wake them. Why couldn't it have been something simple, like love letters from another woman? There would have been a good row, Marguerite would have confessed her own affair, lovers would have been relinquished, and soon their home would return to normal. But she hadn't found love letters. She'd found something much worse. For a moment, she blamed herself. If she hadn't been searching his study, she never would have found the photographs. She could have spent the rest of her life in blissful oblivion, believing her husband was the man he appeared to be. But now she knew. Her husband was a monster, his life a lie, a complete and meticulously maintained lie. Therefore, she too was a lie. Marguerite Rolfe concentrated on her work, making slow and steady progress. After an hour, it was done. A good hole, she decided, about 6 feet in length and 2 feet across. 6 inches below the surface, she had encountered a dense layer of clay. As a result, it was a bit shallower than she would have preferred. It didn't matter. She knew it wasn't permanent. She picked up the gun. It was her husband's favorite weapon. A beautiful shotgun, handcrafted for him by a master gunsmith in Milan. He would never be able to use it again. This pleased her. She thought of Anna. Please don't wake up, Anna. Sleep, my love. Then she stepped into the ditch, lay down on her back, placed the end of the barrel in her mouth, pulled the trigger. The girl was awakened by music. She did not recognize the piece and wondered how it had found its way into her head. It lingered a moment, a descending series of notes, a serene diminishment. She reached out, eyes still closed, and searched the folds of the bedding until her palm found the body, which lay a few inches away. Her fingers slipped over the narrow waist, up the slender, elegant neck, toward the graceful curved features of the scroll. Last night they had quarreled. Now it was time to set aside their differences and make peace. She eased from the bed, pulled on a dressing gown. 5 hours of practice stretched before her. 13 years old, a sun-drenched June morning, and this was how she would spend her day, and every other day that summer. Stretching the muscles of her neck, she gazed out the window at the flowering garden. It was a melee of spring color. Beyond the garden rose the steep slope of the valley wall. High above it all loomed the snow-capped mountain peaks, glittering in the bright summer sun. She pressed her violin to her neck and prepared to play the first étude. Then she noticed something in the garden, a mound of dirt, a long, shallow hole. From her vantage point in the window, she could see a swath of white fabric stretched across the bottom, and pale hands wrapped around the barrel of a gun. "Mama!" she screamed, and the violin crashed to the floor. She threw open the door to her father's study without knocking. She had expected to find him at his desk, hunched over his ledgers, but instead he was perched on the edge of a high-backed wing chair next to the fireplace. A tiny, elfin figure, he wore his habitual blue blazer and striped tie. He was not alone. The second man wore sunglasses in spite of the masculine gloom of the study. "What on earth do you think you're doing?" snapped her father. "How many times have I asked you to respect my closed door? Can't you see I'm in the middle of an important discussion?" "But, Papa, and put on some proper clothing. 10 o'clock in the morning and you're still wearing only a house coat?" "Papa, I must..." "It can wait until I've finished." "No, it can't, Papa." She screamed this so loudly the man in sunglasses flinched. "I apologize, Otto, but I'm afraid my daughter's manners have suffered from spending too many hours alone with her instrument. Will you excuse me? I won't be but a moment. Anna Rolfe's father handled important documents with care, and the note he removed from the grave was no exception. When he finished reading it, he looked up sharply, his gaze flickering from side to side, as if he feared someone was reading over his shoulder. This Anna saw from her bedroom window. As he turned and started back toward the villa, he glanced up at the window and his eyes met Anna's. He paused, holding her gaze for a moment. It was not a gaze of sympathy or remorse. It was a gaze of suspicion. She turned from the window. The Stradivarius lay where she had dropped it. She picked it up. Downstairs she heard her father calmly telling his guest of his wife's suicide. She lifted the violin to her neck, laid the bow upon the strings, closed her eyes. G minor. Various patterns of ascent and descent. Arpeggios. Broken thirds.
How can she play at a time like this?
I'm afraid she knows little else. Late afternoon, the two men alone in the study again. The police had completed their initial investigation and the body had been removed. The note lay on the drop-leaf table between them.
A doctor should give her a sedative.
She doesn't want a doctor. I'm afraid she has her mother's temper and her mother's stubborn nature.
Did the police ask whether there was a note?
I see no need to involve the police in the personal matters of this family, especially when it concerns the suicide of my wife.
And your daughter?
What about my daughter?
She was watching you from the window.
My daughter is my business. I'll deal with her as I see fit.
I certainly hope so. But do me one small favor.
What's that, Otto? His pale hand patted the top of the table until it came to rest on the note.
Burn this damn thing, along with everything else. Make sure no one else stumbles on any unpleasant reminders of the past. This is Switzerland. There is no past.
Part 1. The Present. Chapter 1. London, Zurich. The sometime solvent firm of Isherwood Fine Arts had once occupied a piece of fine commercial property on stylish New Bond Street in Mayfair. Then came London's retail renaissance, and New Bond Street, or New Bond Strasse, as it was derisively known in the trade, was overrun by the likes of Tiffany and Gucci and Versace and Mikimoto. Julian Isherwood and other dealers specializing in museum-quality old masters were driven into St. Jamesian exile, the Bond Street diaspora, as Isherwood was fond of calling it. He eventually settled in a sagging Victorian warehouse in a quiet quadrangle known as Mason's Yard, next to the London offices of a minor Greek shipping company and a pub that catered to pretty office girls who rode motor scooters. Among the incestuous backbiting villagers of St. James's, Isherwood Fine Arts was considered rather good theatre. Isherwood Fine Arts had drama and tension, comedy and tragedy, stunning highs and seemingly bottomless lows. This was, in large measure, a consequence of its owner's personality. He was cursed with a near-fatal flaw for an art dealer. He liked to possess art more than to sell it. Each time a painting left the wall of his exquisite exposition room, Isherwood fell into a raging blue funk. As a result of this affliction, he was now burdened by an apocalyptic inventory of what is affectionately known in the trade as dead stock, paintings for which no buyer would ever pay a fair price. Unsellable paintings. Burned, as they like to say in Duke Street. Toast. If Isherwood had been asked to explain this seemingly inexplicable failure of business acumen, he might have raised the issue of his father, though he made a point of never, and I mean never, peddle, talking about his father. He was up now, afloat, flush with funds. £1,000,000, to be precise, tucked nicely into his account at Barclays Bank, thanks to a Venetian painter named Francesco Vecellio and the morose-looking art restorer, now making his way across the wet bricks of Mason's Yard. Isherwood pulled on a mackintosh. His English scale and devoutly English wardrobe concealed the fact that he was not, at least not technically speaking, English at all. English by nationality and passport, yes, but German by birth, French by upbringing, and Jewish by religion. Few people knew that his last name was merely a phonetic perversion of its original. Fewer still knew that he'd done favours over the years for a certain bullet-headed gentleman from a certain clandestine agency based in Tel Aviv. Rudolf Heller was the name the gentleman used when calling on Isherwood at the gallery. It was a borrowed name, borrowed, like the gentleman's blue suit and gentleman's manners. His real name was Ari Shamron.
"One makes choices in life, doesn't one?"
Shamron had said at the time of Isherwood's recruitment.
"One doesn't betray one's adopted country, one's college, or one's regiment, but one looks out for one's flesh and blood, one's tribe, lest another Austrian madman or the butcher of Baghdad try to turn us all into soap again, eh, Julian?"
"Hear, hear, hear, Heller.
We won't pay you a pound. Your name will never appear in our files. You'll do favors for me from time to time. Very specific favors for a very special agent."
"Super. Marvelous. Where do I sign up?" "What sort of favors?"
"Nothing shady, I take it."
"Say, I need to send him to Prague, or Oslo, or Berlin, God forbid. I'd like you to find legitimate work for him there. A restoration, an authentication, a consultation. Something appropriate for the amount of time he'll be staying."
"Not a problem, Herr Heller. By the way, does this agent of yours have a name?"
The agent had many names, thought Isherwood now, watching the man make his way across the quadrangle. His real name was Gabriel Allon, and the nature of his secret work for Shamron was betrayed by subtle things he did now. The way he glanced over his shoulder as he slipped through the passageway from Duke Street. The way that, in spite of a steady rain, he made not one but two complete circuits of the old yard before approaching the gallery's secure door and ringing Isherwood's bell.
Poor Gabriel. One of the three or four best in the world at what he does. But he can't walk a straight line.
And why not? After what happened to his wife and child in Vienna. No man would be the same after that. He was unexpectedly average in height, and his smooth gait seemed to propel him effortlessly across Duke Street to Green's restaurant, where Isherwood had booked a table for lunch. As they sat down, Gabriel's eyes flickered about the room like searchlights. They were almond-shaped, unnaturally green, and very quick. The cheekbones were broad and square, the lips dark, and the sharp-edged nose looked as though it had been carved from wood. It was a timeless face, thought Isherwood. It could be a face on the cover of a glossy men's fashion magazine, or a face from a dour Rembrandt portrait. It was also a face of many possible origins. It had been a superb professional asset. Isherwood ordered stuffed sole and Sancerre, Gabriel black tea and a bowl of consommé. He reminded Isherwood of an orthodox hermit who subsisted on rancid feta and concrete flatbread. Only Gabriel lived in a pleasant cottage on a remote tidal creek in Cornwall, instead of a monastery. Isherwood had never seen him eat a rich meal, had never seen him smile or admire an attractive pair of hips. He never lusted after material objects. He had only two toys, an old MG motor car and a wooden ketch, both of which he had restored himself. He listened to his opera on a dreadful little portable CD player stained with paint and varnish. He spent money only on his supplies. He had more high-tech toys in his little Cornish studio than there were in the conservation department of the Tate. How little Gabriel had changed in the 25 years since they had first met. A few more wrinkles around those watchful eyes, a few more pounds on his spare frame. He'd been little more than a boy that day, quiet as a church mouse. Even then his hair was streaked with grey, the stain of a boy who'd done a man's job.
"Julian Isherwood, meet Gabriel," Shamron had said. Gabriel is a man of enormous talent, I assure you.
Enormous talent indeed, but there had been gaps in the young man's provenance, like the missing 3 years between his graduation from the prestigious Bezalel School of Art in Jerusalem and his apprenticeship in Venice with the master restorer Umberto Conti.
Gabriel spent time traveling in Europe,
Shamron had said curtly. That was the last time the subject of Gabriel's European adventures was ever raised. Julian Isherwood didn't talk about what had happened to his father, and Gabriel didn't talk about the things he had done for Ari Shamron, alias Rudolf Heller, from approximately 1972 to 1975. Secretly, Isherwood referred to them as the lost years. Isherwood reached into the breast pocket of his jacket and withdrew a check. Your share from the sale of the Vecellio, £100,000. Gabriel scooped up the check and pocketed it with a smooth movement of his hand. He had magician's hands and a magician's sense of misdirection. The check was there, the check was gone.
How much was your share?
I'll tell you, but you must first promise me that you won't divulge the figure to any of these vultures, Isherwood said, sweeping his hand across the dining room of greens. Gabriel said nothing, which Isherwood interpreted as a blood oath of everlasting silence.
$1 million.
Dollars?
Pounds, Petal, pounds.
Who bought it? A very nice gallery in the American Midwest. Tastefully displayed, I assure you. Can you imagine? I picked it up for $16,000 from a dusty sale room in Hull on the hunch, the wild, bloody hunch, that it was the missing altarpiece from the Church of San Salvatore in Venice. And I was right. A coup like this comes along once in a career, twice if you're lucky. Cheers. They toasted each other, stemmed wine glass to bone china teacup. Just then a tubby man with a pink shirt and pink cheeks to match presented himself breathlessly at their table.
Julie, he sang.
Hello, Oliver.
Word on Duke Street is you picked up a cool million for your Vecellio.
Where the bloody hell did you hear that?
There are no secrets down here, love. Just tell me if it's the truth or a dirty, seditious lie.
He turned to Gabriel as if noticing him for the first time, and thrust out a fleshy paw with a gold-embossed business card wedged between the thick fingers.
Oliver Dimbleby, Dimbleby of Fine Arts.
Gabriel took the card silently.
Why don't you join us for a drink, Oliver?
Said Isherwood. Beneath the table, Gabriel put his foot on Isherwood's toe and pressed hard.
Can't now, love. That leggy creature in the booth over there has promised to whisper filth into my ear if I buy her another glass of champagne.
Thank God,
blurted Isherwood through clenched teeth. Oliver Dimbleby waddled off. Gabriel released the pressure on Isherwood's foot.
So much for your secrets.
Vultures,
Isherwood repeated. I'm up now, but the moment I stumble, they'll be hovering again, waiting for me to die so they can pick over the bones.
Maybe this time you should watch your money a little more carefully.
I'm afraid I'm a hopeless case. In fact,
oh, God.
I'm traveling to Amsterdam to have a look at a painting next week. It's the centerpiece of a triptych, classified as artist unknown,
but I have another one of my hunches.
I think it may have come from the workshop of Roger van der Weyden. In fact, I may be willing to bet a great deal of money on it.
Van der Weydens are notoriously difficult to authenticate. There are only a handful of works firmly attributed to him, and he never signed or dated any of them.
If it came from his workshop, his fingerprints will be on it. And if there's anyone who can find them, it's you.
I'll be happy to take a look at it for you.
Are you working on anything now?
I just finished the Modigliani.
I have a job for you.
What kind of job?
I received a call from a lawyer a few days ago. Said his client has a painting that requires cleaning. Said his client wanted you to handle the job and would pay handsomely.
What's the client's name?
Didn't say.
What's the painting? Didn't say. So how is it supposed to work? You go to the villa, you work on the painting, the owner pays for your hotel and expenses. Where?
Zurich.
Something flashed behind Gabriel's green eyes. A vision. A memory. Isherwood frantically rifled through the file drawers of his own less reliable memory. Have I ever sent him to Zurich for Herr Heller?
Is Zurich a problem?
No, Zurich is fine. How much would I be paid?
Twice what I've just given you, if you start right away.
Give me the address.
Gabriel did not have time to return to Cornwall to pick up his things. So, after lunch, he went shopping. In Oxford Street he purchased 2 changes of clothing and a small leather bag. Then he walked over to Great Russell Street and visited the venerable art supply store of L. Cornelison and Son. A flaxen-haired angel called Penelope helped him assemble a travelling kit of pigments, brushes, and solvents. She knew him by his work name, and he flirted with her shamelessly in the faded accent of an Italian expatriate. She wrapped his things in brown paper and bound them with a string. He kissed her cheek. Her hair smelled of cocoa and incense. Gabriel knew too much about terrorism and security to enjoy travelling by airplane, so he rode the underground to Waterloo Station and caught a late afternoon Eurostar to Paris. In the Gare de l'Est, he boarded a night train for Zurich, and by 9 o'clock the next morning, he was strolling down the gentle sweep of the Bahnhofstrasse. How gracefully Zurich conceals her riches, he thought. Much of the world's gold and silver lay in the bank vaults beneath his feet, but there were no hideous office towers to mark the boundaries of the financial district, and no monuments to money-making. Just understatement, discretion, and deception. A scorned woman who looks away to hide her shame. Switzerland. He came upon the Paradeplatz. On one side of the square stood the headquarters of Credit Suisse, on the other the Union Bank of Switzerland. A burst of pigeons shattered the calm. He crossed the street. Opposite the Savoy Hotel was a taxi stand. He climbed into a waiting car after first glancing at the registration number and committing it to memory. He gave the driver the address of the villa, doing his best to conceal the Berlin accent he had acquired from his mother. Crossing the river, the driver switched on the radio. An announcer was reading the overnight news. Gabriel struggled to comprehend his Zürich. He tuned out the radio and focused on the task ahead. There were some in the art world who thought of restoration as tedious work, but Gabriel viewed each assignment as an adventure waiting to unfold. An opportunity to step through a looking-glass into another time and place, a place where success or failure was determined by his own skills and nerve, and nothing else. He wondered what awaited him. The very fact that the owner had specifically requested him meant that the work was almost certainly an old master. He could also assume that the painting was quite dirty and damaged. The owner wouldn't have gone to the trouble and expense of bringing him to Zurich if it required only a fresh coat of varnish. So how long would he be here? 6 weeks? 6 months? Difficult to say. No 2 restorations were the same. Much would depend on the condition of the painting. Isherwood's Vecellio had required 1 year to restore, though he had taken a brief sabbatical in the middle of the job, courtesy of Ari Shamron. The Rosenboulevard was a narrow street, just wide enough to accommodate 2 cars at once, and it rose sharply up the slope of the Zürichberg. The villas were old and big and huddled closely together. Stucco walls, tile roofs, small tangled gardens, all except the one where the taxi driver pulled to a stop. It stood atop its own promontory, and unlike its neighbours, was set several metres back from the street. A high metal fence like the bars of a jail cell ran round the perimeter. At the level of the pavement, there was a security gate, complete with a small surveillance camera. Beyond the gate rose a flight of stone steps. Then came the villa, a melancholy greystone structure with turrets and a towering front portico. The taxi drove off. Below lay central Zurich and the lake.
Cloud veiled the far shore. Gabriel remembered that it was possible to see the Alps on a clear day, but now they too were shrouded. Mounted next to the gate on a stone wall was a telephone. Gabriel picked up the receiver, heard ringing at the other end of the line, waited. Nothing. He replaced the receiver, picked it up again. Still no answer. He pulled out the lawyer's fax that Julian Isherwood had given him in London. You are to arrive at precisely 9 a.m., ring the bell, and you'll be escorted inside. Gabriel looked at his watch. 9:03. As he slipped the papers back into his pocket, it began to rain. He looked around. No cafes where he might sit in comfort, no parks or squares where he might find some shelter from the weather. Just a desert of inherited residential wealth. If he stood on the pavement too long, he'd probably be arrested for loitering. He pulled out his mobile phone and dialed Isherwood's number. He was probably still on his way to the gallery. As Gabriel waited for the connection to go through, he had a mental image of Isherwood hunched over the wheel of his shining new Jaguar motor car, crawling along Piccadilly as if he were piloting an oil tanker through treacherous waters.
"Sorry, but I'm afraid there's been a change in plan. The fellow who was supposed to meet you was apparently called out of town suddenly, an emergency of some sort. He was vague about it. You know how the Swiss can be, Petal."
"What am I supposed to do?"
"He sent me the security codes for the gate and the front door. You're to let yourself in. There's supposed to be a note for you on the table in the entrance hall explaining where you can find the painting and your accommodations."
"Rather unorthodox, don't you think?"
"Consider yourself fortunate. It sounds as if you're going to have the run of the place for a few days, and you won't have anyone watching over your shoulder while you work."
"I suppose you're right.
Let me give you the security codes. Do you have paper and pen by any chance? They're rather long."
"Just tell me the numbers, Julian. It's pouring rain, and I'm getting soaked out here."
"Ah, yes, you and your little parlor tricks. I used to have a girl at the gallery who could do the same thing."
Isherwood rattled off two series of numbers, each 8 digits in length, and severed the connection. Gabriel lifted the receiver of the security phone and punched in the numbers. A buzzer sounded. He turned the latch and stepped through the gate. At the front entrance of the house, he repeated the routine, and a moment later he was standing in the darkened front hall, groping for a light switch. The envelope lay in a large glass bowl on a carved antique table at the foot of the staircase. It was addressed to Signore Del Vecchio, Gabriel's work name. He picked up the envelope and sliced it open with his forefinger. Plain, dove-gray paper, heavy bond, no letterhead. Precise, careful handwriting. Unsigned. He lifted it to his nose. No scent. Gabriel began to read. The painting hung in the drawing room, a Raphael, portrait of a young man. A reservation had been made for him at the Dolder Grand Hotel, about a mile away on the other side of the Zurichberg. There was food in the refrigerator. The owner would return to Zurich the following day. He would appreciate it greatly if Signore Del Vecchio could begin work without delay. Gabriel slipped the note into his pocket. So, a Raphael. It would be his second. 5 years ago he had restored a small devotional piece, a Madonna and Child, based on the renowned composition of Leonardo. Gabriel could feel a tingling sensation spreading over the tips of his fingers. It was a marvelous opportunity. He was glad he had taken the job, regardless of the unorthodox arrangements. He stepped through a passageway into a large room. It was dark, no lights burning, the heavy curtains tightly drawn. Despite the gloom, he had the sensation of Middle European aristocratic clutter. He took a few steps forward. Beneath his feet, the carpet was damp. The air tasted of salt and rust. It was an odor Gabriel had smelled before. He reached down, touched his fingers to the carpet, and brought them to his face. He was standing in blood. The oriental carpet was faded and very old, and so was the dead man sprawled in the center of it. He lay face down, and in death he was reaching forward with his right hand. He wore a double-vented blue blazer, shiny with wear in the back, and grey flannel trousers. His shoes were brown suede. One shoe, the right, had a thickened heel and sole. The trousers had ridden up along his lower leg. The skin was shockingly white, like exposed bone. The socks were mismatched. Gabriel squatted on his haunches with the casualness of someone who was at ease around the dead. The corpse had been a tiny man, 5 feet in height, no more. He lay in profile, the left side of the face exposed. Through the blood, Gabriel could see a square jaw and a delicate cheekbone. The hair was thick and snowy white. It appeared that the man had been shot once through the left eye, and that the slug had exited the back of the skull. Judging from the size of the exit wound, the weapon was a rather large caliber handgun. Gabriel looked up and saw that the slug had shattered the mirror above the large fireplace. He suspected the old man had been dead a few hours. He supposed he should telephone the police, but then he imagined the situation from their point of view. A foreigner in an expensive home, a corpse shot through the eye. At the very least, he would be detained for questioning. Gabriel couldn't allow that to happen. He rose and turned his gaze from the dead man to the Raphael. A striking image. A beautiful young man in semi-profile, sensuously lit. Gabriel guessed it had been painted while Raphael was living and working in Florence, probably between 1504 and 1508. Too bad about the old man. It would have been a pleasure to restore such a painting. He walked back to the entrance hall, stopped, and looked down. He had tracked blood across the marble floor. There was nothing to be done about it. In circumstances like these, he had been trained to leave quickly without worrying about making a bit of a mess or noise. He collected his cases, opened the door, and stepped outside. It was raining harder now, and by the time he reached the gate at the end of the flagstone walk, he was no longer leaving bloody footprints. He walked quickly until he came to a thoroughfare, the Krabbelstrasse. The number 6 tram slithered down the slope of the hill. He raced it to the next stop, walking quickly but not running, and hopped on without a ticket. The streetcar jerked forward. Gabriel sat down and looked to his right. Scrawled on the carriage wall in black indelible marker was a swastika superimposed over a Star of David. Beneath it were two words, Judenscheiß. The tram took him directly to Hauptbahnhof. Inside the terminal, in an underground shopping arcade, he purchased an exorbitantly priced pair of ballet leather boots. Upstairs in the main hall, he checked the departure board. A train was leaving for Munich in 15 minutes. From Munich, he would make an evening flight back to London, where he would go directly to Isherwood's house in South Kensington and strangle him. He purchased a first-class ticket and walked to the toilet. In a stall, he changed from his loafers into the new boots. On the way out, he dropped the loafers into a rubbish bin and covered them with paper towels. By the time he reached the platform, the train was boarding. He stepped onto the second carriage and picked his way along the corridor until he came to his compartment. It was empty. A moment later, as the train eased forward, Gabriel closed his eyes, but all he could see was the dead man lying at the foot of the Raphael, and the two words scrawled on a streetcar, Judenscheiß. The train slowed to a stop. They were still on the platform. Outside, in the corridor, Gabriel heard footfalls. Then the door to his compartment flew back as though blown open by a bomb, and two police officers burst inside. Chapter 2 Vitoria, Spain. 600 miles to the west, in the Basque town of Vitoria, an Englishman sat amid the cool shadows of the Plaza de España, sipping a coffee at a café beneath the graceful arcade. Though he was unaware of the events taking place in Zurich, they would soon alter the course of his well-ordered life. For now, his attention was focused on the bank entrance across the square. He ordered another café con leche and lit a cigarette. He wore a brimmed hat and sunglasses. His hair had the healthy silver sheen of a man gone prematurely grey. His sandstone-coloured poplin suit matched the prevailing architecture of Vittoria, allowing him to blend chameleon-like into his surroundings. He appeared to be entranced by that morning's editions of El País and El Mundo. He was not. On the pale yellow stonework, a graffiti artist had scrawled a warning. "Tourists, beware. You are not in Spain any longer. This is Basque country." The Englishman did not feel any sense of unease. If, for some reason, he was targeted by the separatists, he was quite certain he would be able to look after himself. His gaze settled on the door of the bank. In a few minutes, a teller called Felipe Navarra would be leaving for his midday break. His colleagues believed he went home for lunch and siesta with his wife. His wife believed he was meeting secretly with his Basque political associates. In reality, Felipe Navarra would be heading to an apartment house in the old town, just off the Plaza de la Virgen Blanca, where he would spend the afternoon with his mistress, a beautiful black-haired girl called Amaya. The Englishman knew this because he had been watching Navarra for nearly a week. At 1:15, Navarra emerged from the bank and headed toward the old town. The Englishman left a handful of pesetas on the table, enough to cover his tab along with a generous tip for the waiter, and trailed softly after him. Entering a crowded market street, he kept to a safe distance. There was no need to get too close. He knew where his quarry was going. Felipe Navarra was no ordinary bank teller. He was an active service agent of the Euskadi Ta Askatasuna, Basque Fatherland and Liberty, better known as ETA. In the lexicon of ETA, Navarra was a sleeping commando. He lived a normal life with a normal job and received his orders from an anonymous commander. A year ago, he had been directed to assassinate an officer of the Guardia Civil. Unfortunately for Navarra, the officer's father was a successful winemaker, a man with plenty of money to finance an extensive search for his son's killer. Some of that money now resided in the Englishman's numbered Swiss bank account. Among the terror experts of Europe, ETA had a reputation for training and operational discipline that rivaled that of the Irish Republican Army, a group with which the Englishman had dealt in the past. But based on the Englishman's observations thus far, Felipe Navarra seemed a rather free-spirited agent. He walked directly toward the girl's flat, taking no security precautions or counter-surveillance measures. It was a miracle he'd managed to kill the Guardia Civil officer and escape. The Englishman thought he was probably doing ETA a favor by eliminating such an incompetent agent. Navarra entered an apartment building. The Englishman walked across the street to a bakery, where he consumed two sugared pastries and drank another café con leche. He didn't like to work on an empty stomach. He looked at his watch. Navarra had been inside for 20 minutes, plenty of time for the preliminaries of a sexual liaison. Crossing the quiet street, he had an amusing thought. If he telephoned Navarra's wife, a redhead with a fiery Basque temper, she would probably do the job for him. But, strictly speaking, that would be a breach of contract. Besides, he wanted to do it himself. The Englishman was happy in his work. He entered the cool, dark foyer. Directly in front of him was the entrance to a shaded courtyard. To his right was a row of post boxes. He mounted the stairs quickly to the door of the girl's flat on the fourth floor. A television was playing, a senseless game show on Antenna 3. It helped to cover the minimal sound the Englishman made while picking the lock. He entered the flat, closed the door, and locked it again. Then he padded into the bedroom. Navarra was seated at the end of the bed. The woman was kneeling on the floor, her head moving rhythmically between his legs. Navarra's fingers were entwined in her hair, and his eyes were closed, so he was unaware of the new presence in the room. The Englishman wondered why they were making love to a game show. "To each his own," he thought. The Englishman crossed the room quickly in three powerful strides, his footfalls covered by the sound of the television. A knife slipped from a sheath on his right forearm and fell into his palm. It was the weapon of a soldier, a heavy, serrated blade, with a thick leather-bound grip. He held it the way he had been trained at the headquarters of his old regiment, on a wind-swept moorland in the Midlands of England. The natural inclination when stabbing a man is to do it from behind, so that the killer and victim are never face to face. But the Englishman had been trained to kill with a knife from the front. In this case it meant the element of surprise was lost, but the Englishman was a creature of habit and believed in doing things by the book. He moved a few feet forward so that he was standing behind the girl. Her hair spilled down a long, V-shaped back. His eye followed the line of her spinal column to the slender waist, to the rounded, child-bearing hips and curved buttocks. Navarra opened his eyes. Frantically he tried to push the girl out of the way. The assassin did it for him, taking a handful of her hair and tossing her across the room, so that she skidded along the hardwood floor on her backside and toppled the standing lamp. Navarra, without taking his eyes from the intruder, reached backward across the rumpled sheets and beat his palm against a twisted pile of clothing. So, he had a gun. The Englishman stepped forward and took hold of the Basque's throat with his left hand, squeezing his larynx to the breaking point. Then he pushed the man down onto the bed, settling atop him with one knee on his abdomen. Navarra writhed, struggling for air, the look on his face a combination of panic and utter resignation. The Englishman thrust the knife into the soft tissue beneath the Basque's ribcage, angling upward toward the heart. The man's eyes bulged and his body stiffened, then relaxed. Blood pumped over the blade of the knife. The Englishman removed the knife from the dead man's chest and stood up. The girl scrambled to her feet. Then she stepped forward and slapped him hard across the face. "Who the hell do you think you are?" The Englishman didn't know quite what to make of this woman. She had just watched him stab her lover to death, but she was acting as if he had tracked mud across her clean floor. She hit him a second time. "I work for Aragon, you idiot. I've been seeing Navarra for a month. We were about to arrest him and take down the rest of his cell. Who sent you here? It wasn't Aragon. He would have told me." She stood there awaiting his reply, seemingly unashamed of her nudity. "I work for Castillo." He spoke calmly and in fluent Spanish. He didn't know anyone called Castillo. It was just the first name that popped into his head. Where had he seen it? The bakery? Yes, that was it, the bakery across the street. She asked, "Who's Castillo?" "The man I work for." "Does Castillo work for Aragon?" "How should I know? Why don't you call Aragon? He'll call Castillo and we'll straighten this mess out." "Fine. Call him on that telephone over there." "I will, you fucking idiot." "Just do it quietly, before you alert every tenant in the building that we've just killed a man." She folded her arms across her breasts, as if she was aware of her nakedness for the first time. "What's your name?"
"I'm not telling you my name."
"Why not?"
"How do I know you really work for Aragon? Maybe you work with Loverboy here. Maybe you're a member of his cell. Maybe you're going to call some of his friends and they'll come here and kill me."
He raised the bloody knife and ran his thumb across the blade. The girl scowled.
"Don't even think about trying it, fucking idiot. Get Aragon on the line, then I'll tell you my name. You're going to be in big trouble."
"Just get Aragon on the phone, and I'll explain everything." She sat down on the edge of the bed, snatched up the receiver, and violently punched in the number. The Englishman moved a step closer and placed his finger on the cradle, severing the connection.
"What do you think you're doing? What's your name?"
The assassin brought the blade across her throat in a slashing movement. He stepped back to avoid the initial geyser-like burst of blood. Then he knelt before her and watched the life draining out of her eyes. As she slipped away, he leaned forward and whispered his name into her ear. The Englishman spent the rest of the day driving, the fast road, from Vitoria to Barcelona, then the coast highway from Barcelona across the border to Marseille. Late that evening, he boarded a passenger ferry for the night crossing to Corsica. He was dressed like a typical Corsican man, loose-fitting cotton trousers, dusty leather sandals, a heavy sweater against the autumn chill. His dark brown hair was cropped short. The poplin suit and brimmed hat he'd worn in Victoria were resting in the rubbish bin of a roadside cafe in Bordeaux. The silver wig had been tossed out the car window into a mountain gorge. The car itself, registered to a David Mandelson, one of his many false identities, had been returned to the rental agent in town. He went below deck to his cabin. It was private, with its own shower and toilet. He left his small leather grip on the berth and went up to the passenger deck. The ferry was nearly empty, a few people gathering in the bar for a drink and a bite to eat. He was tired after the long drive, but his strict sense of internal discipline would not permit him to sleep until he had scanned the faces of the passengers. He toured the deck, saw nothing alarming, then went into the bar, where he ordered a half-liter of red wine and fell into conversation with a Corsican named Matteo. Matteo lived in the northwest part of the island, like the Englishman, but two valleys to the south in the shadow of Monte d'Oro. It had been 20 years since he had been to the Englishman's valley. Such was the rhythm of life on the island. The conversation turned to the arson fire that had ravaged the Englishman's valley the previous dry season.
"Did they ever find out who did it?"
Matteo asked, helping himself to some of the Englishman's wine. When the Englishman told him the authorities suspected the separatists from the FLNC, the Corsican lit a cigarette and spit smoke at the ceiling. "Young hotheads," he growled, and the Englishman nodded slowly in agreement. After an hour, he bid Matteo good night and returned to his cabin. In his suitcase was a small radio. He listened to the midnight newscast on a Marseille station. After a few minutes of local news, there was a roundup of foreign stories. In the West Bank, there had been another day of fighting between Palestinian and Israeli forces. In Spain, two members of the Basque terror group, ETA, had been murdered in the town of Vitoria. And in Switzerland, a prominent banker named Augustus Rolf had been found murdered in his home in an exclusive Zurich neighborhood. An unidentified man was in custody. The Englishman switched off the radio, closed his eyes, and was immediately asleep. Chapter 3. Zurich. The headquarters of the Stadtpolizei Zürich was located only a few hundred meters from the train station on the Zughausstrasse, wedged between the smoke-colored Seal River and a sprawling rail yard. Gabriel had been led across a stone central courtyard into the aluminum and glass annex which housed the murder squad. There he was placed in a windowless interrogation room, furnished with a table of blonde wood and a trio of mismatched chairs. His luggage had been seized along with his paints, brushes, and chemicals. So had his wallet, his passport, and his mobile telephone. They had even taken his wristwatch. He supposed they were hoping he would become disoriented and confused. He was confident that he knew more about the techniques of interrogation than the Zurich police did. He had been questioned 3 times by 3 different officers, once, briefly, at the train station, before being taken into custody, and 2 more in this room. Judging by clothing and age, the importance of his interrogators was getting progressively greater. The door opened and a single officer entered the room. He wore a tweed coat and no tie. He called himself Sergeant Major Bear. He sat down opposite Gabriel, placed a file on the table, and stared at it as if it was a chessboard and he was contemplating his next move.
"Tell me your name," he blurted in English. "It hasn't changed since the last time I was asked.
Tell me your name."
"My name is Mario Del Vecchio. Where do you reside?"
"Port Navas, Cornwall." "England?"
"Yes."
"You are an Italian, but you live in England."
"That's not a crime, the last time I checked."
"I didn't say it was, but it is interesting, though. What do you do in Port Navas, England?"
"I told the 3 officers who questioned me."
"Yes, I know. I'm an art restorer." "Why are you in Zurich?"
"I was hired to clean a painting.
At the villa on the Zurich Berg?
Yes.
Who hired you to clean this painting? Clean? Is that the word you used? Peculiar word, clean. One thinks of cleaning floors, cleaning cars or clothing, but not paintings. Is that a common expression in your line of work?
Yes, said Gabriel, and the inspector seemed disappointed. He did not elaborate.
Who hired you?
I don't know.
What do you mean?
I mean, it was never made clear to me. The arrangements were made by a lawyer in Zurich and an art dealer in London.
Ah, yes, Julius Isherwood.
Julian.
With a Germanic reverence for paperwork, the detective made a vast show of expunging the offending word and carefully penciling in the correction. When he had finished, he looked up triumphantly as if awaiting applause.
Go on.
I was simply told to go to the villa.
I would be met there and shown inside.
Met by whom?
That was never made clear to me.
Isherwood's fax was in the file. The detective slipped on a pair of half-moon glasses and held the fax up to the light. His lips moved as he read.
When did you arrive in Zurich? You have the stub of my train ticket. You know that I arrived this morning.
The detective pulled a frown that said he did not like suspects telling him what he did and didn't know.
Where did you go after you arrived?
Straight to the villa.
You didn't check into your hotel first?
No, I didn't know where I was staying yet.
Where were you planning to stay?
As you can see from the note that was left for me at the villa, arrangements had been made for me to stay at the Dulder Grand Hotel.
Bear overlooked this seeming misstep and carried on.
How did you get from Hauptbahnhof to the villa?
By taxi.
How much was the fare?
About 15 francs.
What time did you arrive at the villa?
9:02.
How can you be so certain of the time?
Look at the facts from Julian Isherwood. I was told to arrive at precisely 9:00. I don't make a habit of being late for appointments, Sergeant Major Bear.
The detective smiled in admiration. He was a prompt man, and he appreciated punctuality and attention to detail in others, even if he suspected them of murder.
And when you arrived at the villa?
I used the security phone, but no one answered. So I called Mr. Isherwood in London. He told me that the person who was supposed to meet me had been called out of town suddenly.
Is that what he said? Called out of town?
Something like that.
And this Mr. Isherwood gave you the codes?
Yes.
Who gave Mr. Isherwood the codes?
I don't know. The man's a lawyer, I suppose.
Did you write the codes down?
No.
Why not?
It wasn't necessary.
Why not?
Because I memorized the codes.
Really? You must have a very good memory, Signore Del Vecchio.
The detective left the room for 15 minutes. When he returned, he had a cup of coffee for himself, and nothing for Gabriel. He sat down and resumed where he had left off.
These arrangements seem peculiar to me, Signore Del Vecchio. Is it customary that you are kept unaware of the artist until you arrive to begin work on restoration?
No, it isn't customary. In fact, it's unusual.
Indeed.
He sat back and folded his arms, as though this admission were tantamount to a signed confession.
Is it also customary that you are not given the name of the owner of a painting you are restoring?
It's not unheard of.
Rolf.
He looked at Gabriel to see if the name produced any reaction, which it did not.
The person who owns the painting is named Augustus Rolf. He is also the man you murdered in the villa.
I didn't murder anyone, and you know it.
He was killed long before I arrived in Zurich. I was still on the train when he was murdered. 100 people can place me on that train.
The detective seemed unmoved by Gabriel's argument. He sipped his coffee and said calmly, "Tell me what happened after you entered the villa." Gabriel recounted the chain of events in a dull monotone. The dark entrance hall, groping for the light switch, the unsigned letter in the bowl on the table, the strange odor on the air as he entered the drawing room, the discovery of the body.
Did you see the painting?
Yes.
Before you saw the body or after?
After.
And how long did you look at it?
I don't know. A minute or so.
You've just discovered a dead body, but you stopped to look at a painting.
The detective didn't seem to know what to make of this piece of information.
Tell me about this painter.
He looked down at his notes.
Raphael. I'm afraid I know little of art.
Gabriel could tell he was lying, but decided to play along. For the next 15 minutes, he delivered a detailed lecture on the life and work of Raphael, his training and his influences, the innovations of his technique, the lasting relevance of his major works. By the time he had finished, the policeman was staring into the remains of his coffee, a beaten man.
Would you like me to go on?
No, thank you. That was very helpful. If you did not kill Augustus Rolf, why did you leave the villa without telephoning the police? Why did you try to flee Zurich?
I knew the circumstances would appear suspicious, so I panicked.
The detective looked him over skeptically, as if he did not quite believe Mario Del Vecchio was a man given to panic.
How did you get from the Zurich Berg to the Hauptbahnhof?
I took the tram.
Baer made a careful inspection of Gabriel's seized possessions.
I don't see a tram ticket among your things. Surely you purchased a ticket before you boarded the streetcar.
Gabriel shook his head, guilty as charged. Baer's eyebrows shot up. The notion that Gabriel had boarded a tram ticketless seemed more horrifying to him than the possibility that he had shot an old man in the head.
That's a very serious offense, Signore Del Vecchio. I'm afraid you're going to be fined 50 francs.
I'm deeply sorry.
Have you been to Zurich before?
No, never.
Then how did you know which tram would take you to the Hauptbahnhof?
It was a lucky guess, I suppose. It was heading in the right direction, so I got on.
Tell me one more thing, Signore Del Vecchio. Did you make any purchases while you were in Zurich?
Purchases?
Did you buy anything? Did you do any shopping?
I bought a pair of shoes.
Why?
Because while I was waiting to get into the villa, my shoes became soaked in the rain.
You were panicked. You were afraid to go to the police, desperate to get out of Zurich, but you took time to get new shoes because your feet were wet?
Yes.
He leaned back in his chair and knocked on the door. It opened, and an arm appeared holding an evidence bag containing Gabriel's shoes.
We found these in a toilet at the Hauptbahnhof, buried in a rubbish bin. I suspect they're yours. I also suspect that they will match the set of bloody footprints we found in the entrance hall and the walkway of the villa.
I've already told you I was there.
The footprints, if they do match those shoes, prove nothing.
Rather nice shoes to simply toss away in the toilet of a rail station,
and they don't look that wet to me.
He looked up at Gabriel and smiled briefly.
But then I've heard it said that people who panic easily often have sensitive feet.
It was 3 hours before Baer entered the room again. For the first time he was not alone. It was obvious to Gabriel that the new man represented higher authority. It was also obvious that he was not an ordinary detective from the Zurich murder squad. Gabriel could see it in the small ways that Baer deferred to him physically, the way his heels clicked together when, like a head waiter, he seated the new man at the interrogation table and moved unobtrusively into the background. The man called himself Peterson. He provided no first name and no professional information. He wore an immaculately pressed suit of charcoal grey and a banker's tie. His hair was nearly white and neatly trimmed. His hands, folded on the table in front of him, were the hands of a pianist. On his left wrist was a thick silver watch, Swiss-made, of course, with a dark blue face,
an instrument that could withstand the pressure of great depths. He studied Gabriel for a moment with slow, humorless eyes. He had the natural arrogance of a man who knows secrets and keeps files. The security codes. Like Bear, he spoke to Gabriel in English, though almost without a trace of an accent. Where did you write them down?
I didn't write them down, as I told Sergeant Major Bear.
I know what you told Sergeant Major Bear. His eyes suddenly came to life. I'm asking you for myself. Where did you write them down?
I received the codes over the telephone from Mr. Isherwood in London, and I used them to open the security gate and the front door of the villa.
You committed the numbers to memory?
Yes.
Give them to me now.
Gabriel recited the numbers calmly. Peterson looked at Bear, who nodded once.
You have a very good memory, Signore Del Vecchio.
He had switched from English to German. Gabriel stared back at him blankly as if he did not understand. The interrogation resumed in English.
You don't speak German, Signore Del Vecchio.
No.
According to the taxi driver, the one who took you from the Bahnhofstrasse to the villa on the Zürichberg, you speak German quite well.
Speaking a few words of German and actually speaking German are two very different things.
The driver told us that you gave him the address in rapid and confident German with the pronounced accent of a Berliner. Tell me something, Signore Del Vecchio. How is it that you speak German with the accent of a Berliner?
I told you, I don't speak German. I speak a few words of German. I spent a few weeks in Berlin restoring a painting. I suppose I acquired the accent while I was there.
How long ago was that?
About 4 years ago.
About 4 years?
Yes.
Which painting?
I'm sorry?
The painting you restored in Berlin. Who was the artist? What was it called?
I'm afraid that's confidential.
Nothing is confidential at this point, Signore Del Vecchio. I'd like the name of the painting and the name of the owner.
It was a Caravaggio in private hands. I'm sorry, but I cannot divulge the name of the owner.
Peterson held out his hand towards Bear without looking at him. Bear reached into his file folder and handed him a single sheet of paper. He reviewed it sadly, as if the patient did not have long to live.
We ran your names through our computer database to see if there happened to be any outstanding arrest warrants for you in Switzerland. I am pleased to announce there was nothing, not even a traffic citation. We asked our friends across the border in Italy to do the same thing. Once again, there was nothing recorded against you. But our Italian friends told us something more interesting. It seems that a Mario Del Vecchio, born 23 September 1951, died in Turin 23 years ago of lymphatic cancer. He looked up from the paper and fixed his gaze on Gabriel. What do you think are the odds of two men having precisely the same name and the same date of birth?
How should I know?
I think they're very long indeed. I think there is only one Mario Del Vecchio, and you stole his identity in order to obtain an Italian passport.
I don't believe your name is Mario Del Vecchio.
In fact, I'm quite certain it isn't.
I believe your name is Gabriel Allon, and that you work for the Israeli Secret Service.
Peterson smiled for the first time, not a pleasant smile, more like a tear in a scrap of paper. Then he carried on.
25 years ago, you murdered a Palestinian playwright living in Zurich named Ali Abdelhamidi. You slipped out of the country an hour after the killing and were probably back home in your bed in Tel Aviv before midnight. This time, I'm afraid you're not going anywhere.
Chapter 4. Zurich. Sometime after midnight, Gabriel was moved from the interrogation room to a holding cell in an adjacent wing of the building.
It was small and institutional grey, with a bare mattress mounted on a steel frame, and a rust-stained toilet that never stopped running. Overhead, a single light bulb buzzed behind a mesh cage. His untouched dinner, a fatty pork sausage, some wilted greens and a pile of greasy potatoes, sat on the ground next to the door like room service, waiting to be collected. Gabriel supposed the pork sausage had been Peterson's idea of a joke. He tried to picture the events he knew were taking place outside these walls. Peterson had contacted his superior. His superior had contacted the Foreign Ministry. By now word had probably reached Tel Aviv. The Prime Minister would be livid. He had enough problems. The West Bank in flames, the peace process in tatters, his brittle coalition crumbling. The last thing he needed was a Kidon, even a former Kidon, behind bars in Switzerland. Yet another office scandal waiting to explode across the front pages of the world's newspapers. And so the lights were certainly burning with urgency tonight in the anonymous office block on Tel Aviv's King Saul Boulevard. And Shamron? Had the call gone out to his lakeside fortress in Tiberias? Was he in or out these days? It was always hard to tell with Shamron. He'd been dug out of his precarious retirement 3 or 4 times, called back to deal with this crisis or that, tapped to serve on some dubious advisory panel, or to sit in wizened judgment on a supposedly independent fact-finding committee. Not long ago he'd been appointed interim chief of the service, the position he'd held the first time he was sent into the Judean wilderness of retirement. Gabriel wondered whether that term had ended. With Shamron, the word interim could mean 100 days or 100 years. He was Polish by birth, but had a Bedouin's elastic sense of time. Gabriel was Shamron's kidon. Shamron would handle it, retired or not. The old man. He'd always been the old man, even during his brief fling with middle age. Where's the old man? Anyone seen the old man? Run for the hills, the old man is coming this way.
This book is continued on Disc 2.